I wonder how many people do need for me to introduce myself. Oh, that's fun. I haven't done it in a while at Pardes. That's good. You'll be bored. I'll figure out something new. I'll figure out something new so those people who have been with me for a while will not be that bored. I also warning old timers, I must have taught this at Pardes probably some 2 or 3 years ago, okay? So that you know, but José Vachonnet, nothing too bad about it. Yofi. So can I tell you stories meanwhile? Yes. I need to tell you stories. Those of you who know me, this will start as an introduction. Just walk in, it's not the session yet. I live in Yafo, which I'm sure you're aware is part of the city-state of Tel Aviv. And I walked out this morning for some stuff, whatever. And you wouldn't know it's Tisha B'Av in Tel Aviv. You just wouldn't know. There's not a difference. And then I come whichever way I come. I normally come with the bus. And I sort of land in Yerushalayim. Wow. It's like a different country. Zimamash lo yuman. It's unbelievable how, I mean, the biggest thing last night among most of my friends, no, many, many, many of my friends are non-observant people. And your classical Israelis, ze tisha b'av machar, ken, beseder. Okay, kind of thing. And the biggest item on the news last night was, for Tel Avivians, jellyfish are over. You can go to the beach, okay? And there is this belief, you know, that during the 3 weeks you have jellyfish because even Tel Avivians need to suffer, okay? And they are normally gone by Tisha B'Av, but they were gone by yesterday. And the biggest thing today is that you can go to the beach in Tel Aviv. Can you imagine that? It's as if, like, it's really two separate countries. It's unbelievable. I was speaking to my son, who is sort of Mesoroti, and his 3.5-year-old does not have gun today because of Tisha B'Av, and they live in Be'er Sheva, and the little one likes to go on the train. So Ori, my son, took him on a short ride from Be'er Sheva to Rahat, which is the first stop after Be'er Sheva. And he was weeping for something, and my son does not wear kippah. And so a man with kippah asked him, so lama yelet boche? And my son turns to me, what do you mean lama? Tisha B'Av, u boche. And this guy looks at my son who doesn't wear kippah as if, how do you happen to know that? You know? And so, yeah, we do live in a weird world. So that's my story for this morning, the flight between these two continents, Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim. Listen, one of the decisions, not the only one, but one of the decisions not to have Yom HaShoah on Tisha B'Av, as many of the Dati Leumi people at the time when the final decision, when the law was passed in 59, I'm taking you into another lecture of mine that some of you have heard more than once. And one of the reasons, not the only one, they did want the connections to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, to the Gvura, to the heroism. But one of the reasons Ben-Gurion, in his very clear mind, knew that if it will be in the Chofesh HaGadol, nobody will know it ever happens, like it is with Tisha B'Av. And oftentimes when I speak to my normal audiences are groups of North Americans. I say North Americans and not Americans because I've lived in Canada, and this is where you become sensitive to that way of speaking. But anyway, so I have this presentation about Israeli society and the Holocaust, or why did we know indeed the new Yad Vashem Museum, and all tour guides in the room have heard it like a zillion times because I give it to people before they go to Yad Vashem. And then I reach the point when I have to discuss how the Holocaust is commemorated in Israel. And I'm speaking normally, slicha, no offense, just a description, normally to reform or just community groups or federation groups or whatever. And I mentioned this thing, this pull and shove between Tisha B'Av and the date that we have Yom HaShoah, and people don't get why Tisha B'Av. Like, they too do not know. And so I say to them, the fact that you do not know about it, it's because it's in the summer. And who goes to shul in the summer? You know, you show up for the high holidays, don't you? And they all sort of smile and okay, we need to go another 3 minutes. Ask me anything. My best, no, we shall not discuss my chocolate mousse recipes on Shabbat. Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's do the introduction. Okay, so my name is Rachel Korozim, born and raised in this country, prior to the countries, to the states, so you know how old I am. On my next birthday, which is in October, totally irrelevant to our topic, I'll be 69. So that tells you that had I, just come in, it's just talk before the session, we haven't started. It's just blah, blah. And you know me, guys, so you've had the introduction a zillion times. So the fact that my bio is very long because of that, and we are not going to go into all of it. So the thing that I'd like most for people to know about me is that I spent all of my professional life in education, half of it within the Israeli education system, not necessarily the school system, other stuff like the military and so on. I've been many years with the IDF. And also the other half, professional life, working with Jewish educational frameworks outside of Israel, and I use this convoluted sentence, Jewish educational frameworks, so that it includes day schools, congregational schools, summer camping, adult education, synagogue, federations, I've forgotten something, JCCs, and whatever. And I've lived for a short period outside of Israel in Montreal, Canada. Any Canadians? Long ago, 80s, called St. Luke. Going back for the first time after many years comes this fall. And in all that time, totally regardless of titles that I may have held, which are really not very interesting, most of them have been with the Jewish Agency, I dealt with two major topics. How to teach about Israel, how to teach about the Shoah. We're not doing Shoah today because I've done that 3 days ago here at Pardes in the Summer Institute. So they have decided to do my other topic. And now I can officially go into the introduction of the topic. Ah, and what else about me? Thank God there is a mandatory retirement in the Jewish Agency, as in many other places in Israel. And they retired me when I was 69, which is 62, which is like 7 years ago. And ever since, I'm working 3 times as much, but without the meetings. And that's the fun part. I only do what I like to do, which is research, create new sessions, and teach them. And this is who I am. And on top of that, is there anything that you absolutely need to know about me without which my presentation will make no sense to you? Like the fact that I like cooking desserts, that I have 8 grandchildren, that I'm a scuba diver. What else do you need to know? That covers it, right? Pardon? Which what? War. Yeah, I'm just thinking to answer this properly. So 67 is when I was in uniform, and I had a very painful job of reporting casualties from the Ashkelon military hospital at the time. And that was tough. And I know that God in psychology helped me to totally forget that week. I cannot remember just very, very few details from that. But I remember when the wounded soldiers got the news about the wall, because we were in Ashkelon, and when the news about the Kotel came through on the radio, we didn't have TV in Israel at the time. That's one of the things that I do remember. My mind did not clear that. Anything else that you need to know about me? Done! Shalom, chavirim. Many, many, many years ago, when I was a shlicha, an emissary for the Jewish Agency in Montreal in the 80s, and whenever I come to that part of introducing my topic, I look for somebody for whom the 80s is history. So I see you, young lady, over there. So let me tell you about the 80s. All the others know it, so I need to tell you. No internet, no cell phones, no photocopying machines. And yet we lived. The disconnect from home was terrible. If you lived in North America, in Montreal, like I did at the time, Israeli newspapers would come by airmail on very thin transparent paper. They would arrive to New York, and then they would be shipped to Montreal, and we will get the Shabbat newspaper by Tuesday or something, and we were happy, because none of us knew anything better was coming. The disconnect from home was terrible, and one of the things I missed most was me not being able to be connected to the Israeli literature that I love. So I was writing to my friends back home. Writing, let me specify. Paper, pen, envelope, stamp, 1 week. At least. And if you're lucky and your friends respond the same day, and who does? Then in 2 weeks you'll have your answer, and that's fast, and you're happy. And I said, please look around. If you see anything that you think will interest me, just buy it for me, mail it, I'll pay you when I get back. Money transfers through bank used to be very expensive. They still are. Friends say, don't worry about the money, we'll send you. Now books, you know, they don't go airmail. They go by boat, a whole month. And if you know your North American geography, that will include the St. Lawrence River coming all the way to Montreal, right? It's interesting. But soon enough, the word gets around in Montreal, she's got the new books from Israel. And my Israeli Hebrew-speaking friends will ask me, Rachel, will you do, and I'm using a Hebrew word, we're already into the topic, it's not just blah, blah. Will you do a chug, a circle, for us to read this together? And I know what you are thinking, especially the young people. You're thinking book club, right? Don't. Because in book clubs, we all hold our own copy of the work. And we had one copy, and they haven't invented photocopying machines yet. So I'm going to do something that some people are already doing. It's only for your sake, young lady. I'm going to do this. It symbolizes a process called mimeograph, okay, by which your secretary types out on some sort of special material the text that you want to use, and then it goes to a machine and you have to turn with your hand for every page to make a copy. And yet we studied. It's in one of those circles, not with the Hebrew-speaking ones, but later on with the English-speaking ones, that one of the participants said to me, Rachel, you cannot believe what reading Israeli literature is doing to us. And now you know the classical Israeli sabra that I am, a little bit blasé, not very polite. I went, oh, what's the big deal? You know, I grew up with this literature, so what's the chidush? And she says, no, Rachel, you don't get it. What are the ways for us here in Montreal, 80s, to get to know about Israel? I know I have a rabbi who have served in Canada, so excuse me, rabbi. There are three ways, she said. There is Israel from the pulpit. Comes the parsha of Lech Lecha, comes the parsha of mitzvot that depend on the land, so the rabbi will address. Very insightful, not very contemporary. Then there is Israel of fundraising, you know. Do you know? Oy vey. Like the more miserable we look, the better it is for fundraising, right? And then there is Israel of the media, and that had not changed. There are two venues for us to get into the media. Either we bomb them or they bomb us. And then the woman says to me, Rachel, with reading this, it's as if you have invited us into your own living rooms and let us listen to the intimate Israeli discourse, the stuff that you guys are saying to each other when we are not listening. That is the deal. I'm not teaching classical texts, although a lot of my modern texts are rooted in classical Jewish texts. I'm teaching you contemporary it's so difficult with our vocabulary, sort of secular, because who is to decide who is more chiloni than the other? You know, I'm very careful with these words, but coming from the circles of what is known as chilonim in Israel, a circle. With a couple of exceptions here and there. And I want through that to open a window to Israeli society. This is what I call all my sessions. I have about 30 of them by now. This particular one I called Dialogues with God, Sichot im Borei Olam, in modern Israeli / parentheses secular literature. And do I pretend to any scientific objectivity by which you have read a few of these pieces with me and now you will have a totally scientific analysis of how Israeli secular society is having dialogues, monologues, whatever, challenging relationship with God Almighty? No. No objectivity, no scientific criterion. The only criterion that will get a piece into any of my sessions is that I'm totally in love with it. And I think it will work. Or sometimes I'm totally angry with it and I need for us to have a conversation. So I trust you all have your sheets of sources. If you do not, that used to be a few in the back. Are there still any? If not, there are a couple up front. There are a couple up front, a couple at the end of the room, and make sure you have one, okay? Why don't you place them at the table at the entrance so that as people walk in, they can grab a copy? Beseder? On our way. Done with all the introductions, pretty fast. Let's go, Chavarim. We'll start with a piece by Aharon Ze'ev. I have put Aharon Ze'ev when once I sent these texts to somebody who was very pedantic about that, because normally when you see Ze'ev's poetry, he's addressed as Ze'ev and not Aharon Ze'ev. Just like the poetess Rachel, some people during their lifetime have reached a place in Israeli society that was enough for them to be known by their first name. Should I make inappropriate analogies? Madonna, Cher, whatever, okay? Ze'ev arrives in Israel way, way, way before the state. And the story about this particular poem that is immediately set to music, and maybe we should just call it lyrics to the music, is when Gymnasia Herzliya, and Gymnasia is not a gym, it's a high school. The major, if you wish, place of educating young people in Tel Avivan environment, because Gymnasia Herzliya would have students coming from Rishon LeZion and Rehovot and whatever. It was the school to be at. The teachers that taught there, unbelievable. The building is part of the history of Tel Aviv. This is why we were so busy tearing it down in the early 60s and so on, and building, of course, a shopping mall on top. What else? But anyway, Gymnasia Herzliya, beyond being the high school to graduate from, everybody went there. Alterman studied Herzliya, whatever, okay? And their parents taught there. Was also into the business of innovating Jewish holidays. One, a classical one that we know for almost sure is like a contraption invented by, is the planting on Tu B'Shvat. Because if you go to the biblical Tu B'Shvat, you know that actually is when you should fill in your tax reports, right? According to the biblical meaning of Tu B'Shvat. But here it was, and then it became the holiday of ecology, like holidays evolve with time. So they really have invented this, like, marches and parades going with the JNF planting trees. The other thing they needed to address was Hanukkah. And Hanukkah, I need to explore, and I wonder, it works like magic when I am in my general audiences. Pardes, you guys know too much, but we'll see how it will work, okay? We'll see. What is the major thing that when you think about Hanukkah comes to mind? Like, what is the thing that we are celebrating? Dedicating the temple, what else? The Pach HaShemen, this little urn that would have been in, okay. So dedicating the temple is the end, is the culmination of a victorious war, right? That had been fought when? What in the Maccabees, more or less? Second century before the Common Era. Okay, 165, etc. How do we know about those battles? What are our two sources? Sefer HaMakkabim, which is probably pretty contemporary. We don't know exactly. Our other source? Josephus Flavius, Yosef ben Matityahu, depends which period of his life you want to address. Okay? And when did he live? A good 250 years later? Okay. So we have a source, the date of which we are not so sure about, that's Sefer HaMakkabim. It tells us about all those battles and the elephants and the brothers and the this and the that and all it's there in Sefer HaMakkabim and in Milchamot HaYehudim, the wars of the Jews. That, by the way, take a long time to be translated into English. Only the beginning of the 20th century. Until then, Latin. Okay. And the business was Pach HaShemen. When do we hear about that for the first time? Gemara. So when is that? 4th, 5th, 6th, we don't know exactly, century of the Common Era. How many years after the events? 600 years after the events? 650 years after the events, at least? And probably in Babylon? Okay. So we know about the wars from a period closer. We know about the miracle from a much, much later period. Beseder? Let me ask you a question. When is the time we pick olives in this country? You who live here. In the fall, immediately after Chagim, right? End of October, beginning of November. It takes a couple of weeks for the oil to settle. When in the time in the year when there is absolutely no need for miracles to have fresh, pure olive oil in this country? Like, duh. Do the Hevra in Babylon know about it? They are already hundreds of years away. Their perception of the meaning of the message of events is totally different. And why would our Talmudic sages, so careful of us and our future, want to put the miracle at the center of the holiday when we are already for the 4th or 5th century in exile in Babylon? Why the shift from telling the heroic events like Flavius in the first century to focusing on the miracle? What made the rabbis want to focus on the miracle, on the divine hand in the events? Yes, ma'am. You don't want to talk about victory. Why? What had happened following the Maccabees' revolt? How many revolts, unfortunately, disastrous? By the way, the Maccabean revolt itself wasn't such a great success if you look at the dynasties that followed Bet Hashmonai. Okay? It wasn't a big deal of Shmirat HaTorah, etc. And then comes the Mered HaGadol, which ends with the disaster of the destruction of the temple. And if that was not enough, comes the Mered of Bar Kokhba, which ends with a total disaster. And if that had not been enough, we have Mered HaGaluyot. And that too fails. By the time of creating Gemara in Babylon, the rabbis say, Chevreh, calm down. We are not into revolts anymore. We look at the inner meaning of things, at the hand of God, at miracles, at prayer, at Bameh Madlikin. And we'll put the Chanukiah on the window if it's safe, and inside if it's not so safe. And we'll have our Chag inside. It's not about reclaiming the land anymore. It's not about rebuilding the temple right now. It's something else. Tiragu. Okay? We have suffered too much. And then comes another period at the beginning of the 20th century. And we witness a type of revival. And Ze'ev is asked by Gymnasia Herzliya to create lyrics to a military march that will now change back the meaning of Chanukah to pioneering, not so observant, Eretz Yisrael of the 20s and the 30s. I hope that for the sake of learning, I can sing a little bit, although it's Tisha B'Av, it's not like fun music, Beseder. Those of you who live in Israel and know the song, or who have been in Jewish education elsewhere and taught it, never paying attention to the words, because had you paid attention to the words, you'd never sing it again. Okay? אנו נוסעים לפידים בלילות אפלים זורחים השבילים מתחת רגלנו ומי אשר לב לו הצמא לאור יישא את עיניו וליבו אלינו לאור ויבוא. And now the most important part. נס לא קרה. What? פח שמן לא מצאנו, בסלח חצבנו אדם, ויהי אור. Okay, לעמק הלכנו בהר העלינו, sorry. Let's do the English. We carry torches at night and the dark all around. The past start to shine under our footsteps. And if your heart has it in the thirst for light, you will come and join with your heart to us for the light and the fight. Translation by my son Uri, who is never true to the word, but to the rhythm, so that we can sing it. But you get the sense of it. And the most important part is, of course, the refrain. Miracles do not happen. Nes lo kara lanu. Pach shemen lo matzanu. And what did happen? What did happen to us? What have we done? We did it all ourselves. Can you see the change from Babylon? From the rabbinic, diasporic world? Now, if those of you who have lived most of your lives outside of Israel, especially in the States, and can I see a show of hands? Don't be so angry with us. Think about how Hanukkah is celebrated by many Jews in America. How they have changed to adapt to the environment. And I hear in Jewish day school songs like, on the first day of Hanukkah, la 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 la. You know, it's not from the Gemara. It comes from the environment. Hanukkah is an amazing holiday that had been shaped and reshaped. And now we are looking at a secular third, fourth Aliyah type of change, pre-state, pioneering, okay? So the first message is, gamarnu, done with miracles. The hand of God is out of the story. And we, like the Maccabees, we will do everything with our own hands. Now, I'll let you take a minute with the poem or the lyrics and tell me how many clearly sacrilegious things are included in this poem. Like, I can discern two or three easily, beyond Nes Lo Kara Lanu, beyond miracles do not happen. So first of all, no miracles, that means no divine hand, okay? Ani v'afsi od, I do it everything on my own. How about, we didn't find the urn, so everything the rabbis tell us, finished, gamarnu, not interesting, not relevant. Gemara is out, or at least that particular part of it. How about we walk down the valley, we climbed up the mountain? What is that in reference to? Climbing the mountain, there is a clear isur. Oh! Now look at what is happening. Can Ze'ev, who writes this, be a product of a secular education system? No. He has a serious background. The man is going step after step and challenging the way he and his generation had been educated. With the Isurim, with the Gemara, with the miracle, with the rabbinical teaching. And one after the other, we went down the valley, we climbed the mountain, and now come the part that is always challenging. Mayanot ha'orot ha'gnuzim gilinu. We climbed up the mountains, we climbed, and the lights we discovered. Now, orot gnuzim, the hidden lights. I'll tell you, I have an ongoing discourse with my son Uri, who is a sort of a chavruta in a lot of my work. And I'm the one who is very critical of this and saying they are even going to the fact that those hidden lights are now open to us and we can find them and we can go everywhere. And my son will go, Ima, have a little bit salchanut. Can't you see the yeshiva bocher? Can't you see the Hasidic man in Ze'ev? Can't you see that he's still searching for the same orot gnuzim that he was taught to search for? So have a little rachmonis. So my son is the real mentioned tzaddik in the reading of this poem, and I'm the very critical one. And then we come to the end. Miracles do not happen, nes lo kara lanu. No urn of oil have we found. We dug in the rock till we bled. And then? No, come on, chevra, there is a limit. Like, there is a limit. Ad efo? Ad ana? So now we say vayihi or? We are the ones? It's not the rabbis we are only replacing? It's not the isurim that we trample on? We now become the creators of this new world? Oy. Now, I've often looked at this song. First of all, it took me years until I started wondering about it. Do you know when it is most often sung in Israel? Not in Hanukkah? You don't? Have you ever attended, either physically or facing your TV screen, the declaration of Yom HaTzma'ut when they light the 12 torches, Uletiferet Medinat Yisrael? And at the background music, and I wonder how many years of independence does the state of Israel need before somebody will read the text and say maybe it's disrespectful for at least half of the people who are lighting torches, for at least half of the population of this country. The day will come because they always come those days. But until then, my basic tenet is that we fell in love with the military march, and we never notice the sacrilegious words. Yes, Alexandra.
So what's never been so clear to me with this song is if it's saying, then, back in the time of the Maccabim, Nesu Kavala Nu Kachem Elo Matzalu, or if it's saying, okay, whatever happened there happened, did or didn't, but in our time we don't have miracles, in our time we don't find oil.
I think that it goes both ways, because you know the principle of Miatanacha da Palmach. And I would like to include, we know that principle, like in the way a Israeli secular education system works, we all know our Tanakh. Tanakh we know, pshat. But we know the Tanakh stories. Then there are 2,000 uninteresting years of diaspora, and then Herzl comes and we come back and we create the Palmach. So the natural expression is Israeli history from that perspective is Me'atanach ad Palmach. Like nothing happens in between. So I'd like to include the Maccabees, although they are Sfarim Chitzonim, in that Tanakh perception. The heroic physical connect to the land. Maccabees and us are the same. Look at Chernichovsky. For Rabbi Akiva, Atah HaMakabi, okay? In many, many mentions, we are biblical heroes as we come back. We are Maccabees, as even in Bialik's city of slaughter, when he looks at the miserable kitchen of men who did not fight back and defend their wives and children, said, children of the Maccabees? Sons of the Hasmoneans? So in modern Zionist Israeli literature, Maccabees like Joshua, like King David, are the people we aspire to be like. All that rabbinical literature is really not relevant. One, again, of the most painful places where this is mentioned is, of course, the Declaration of Independence. that starts with the amazing sentence, Be'eretz Yisrael kam ha'am ha'yehudi. It's in the land of Israel that the people of Israel came into being. Ba utzva dmuto haruchanit. This is where our spiritual identity had been shaped, in Eretz Yisrael. Nice. And I thought that Sinai was outside of Eretz Yisrael. And of course, our spiritual existence was shaped without Rambam, without Rashi, without Talmud Bavli, you know, Be'eretz Yisrael. I'm just reading the Declaration of Independence. How do you know that? Ba utzva dmuto haruchanit. That's a tzaddik parshanut like my son. And I will always be the critical voice. Thank you for holding your voice. Thank you. Yeah. You will, I totally can accept that and welcome the Ahavat Chinam that you now express, which is very needed today. I, however, having been raised in this culture, know how it was raised. However, a few years ago, Alexandra, my friend here, was part of that. We were working on creating an educational program for the Milken Community High School of Los Angeles, and we had a unit about Hanukkah, and I very much wanted to include a challenging reading of this song to look at the changes of the Hanukkah story, you know, from the Maccabees time to the Nest time, etc., etc. And one of the people working in the group was an amazing person called Gabriel Porten, and of course observant, and of course being raised in the heart of Zionist observant Yerushalayim. And she says to me, "Oy, Rachel, not that song again." And I said, "Gabriel, how do you at all know it? Where you have been raised, you're not supposed to know it." And he says, "Why not? We always sang it." And I said, "How could you possibly sing it? This is very simple. Nes ken kara lanu pach shemen ken mas." Okay? So, you know, in Israel, miracles will happen. And you can both in Ashomer Tzair and Bnei Akiva march on the Chanukah parade with the torches and everything in Tel Aviv or Haifa, where I was brought up, and both sides of the street can sing the song and everybody be happy. I can tell you, when I teach this in professional development sessions for teachers outside of Israel, sometimes the teachers will tell me, "Rachel, I'll never sing it again. I've never read the words. This is horrible." And some teachers will tell me, just like you, "Lama, it's challenging. It's a discourse. What is it calling upon, etc." So here is a relatively early, not very early Zionist text, but a relatively early Zionist text that is going straight out there into the street, challenging concepts, ways of lives, understandings, and saying, now that we have come into this new phase of reconnecting with Eretz Yisrael, we need to revisit our notions, we need to revisit our relationship with the divine, with miraculous things, with Gemara, etc. Yes, please. Late 20s, I'm thinking, okay? Oh, before the Shoah, definitely before the Shoah. Very definitely before the Shoah. By the way, I did meet Ze'ev once in my life, actually during the Six-Day War. But that's a different story, and I don't want to spend time of the poetry. I'm taking you now to a time where I can more clearly define the moment or the year of writing. We're going to turn the page to Elohim Erachem, God has pity on kindergarten children. We are going to read Yehuda Amichai. There used to be a time that I would check to see, does Yehuda Amichai need an introduction? But I don't want to embarrass anybody, so I'm just giving you a quick Yehuda Amichai introduction. Born in the year 1924 in Würzburg, Germany. Family comes to Eretz Israel in 36 when the man is 12 years of age. So our inner Jewish clock says in time. And indeed, in time, comes to Yerushalayim, where he will have spent most of his life. He starts within the observant Zionist observant circles, goes to Bamale Shule, as it was known, Bamale School. And later on, as many children of immigrants, he will want to out-Sabra every Sabra. So gradually, he will shed the family name, the kippah, the observance, say, join the Palmach. And so not that you needed to shed the kippah to observe, to join the Palmach, but still he did. Politically, he had joined the Labor Party at the time, not that he was ever active, but he was known for his opinions. He becomes a major poetic voice of Israel, starts writing probably around the time of the War of Independence. Some of his poetry will appear, I always used to say 62, but I always continue studying, and I now found out that there were earlier publications in newspapers and stuff in the 50s. But this is a very clear War of Independence reference type of poem. And I'd like to say the following. For many of us, the major catalytic, traumatic event of history as we can perceive it is the Shoah. I'm a daughter of Holocaust survivors. For sure it is for me. I'd like for you, however, to try and focus on a generation of young Israelis who go into the military for the War of Independence, who have lived here from before, who are reaching their early adulthood before Holocaust discourse becomes so central in Israel, like the time of the Eichmann trial. And therefore, the major event shaping, identity-making for them is the War of Independence. 1947, you should count for immediately after the partition decision, all the way to the ceasefire agreements and so on in the beginning of 49. On the day of the declaration of the State of Israel, there are 600,000 Jews in this country. By the end of the War of Independence, we will count 6,000 dead. So it's a full 1% of the population. Chas v'chalila, God forbid that we should even try to imagine what that would mean today. But you can imagine that there is not a family, not a street, not a school, not a teacher in this country who had not attended more than one funeral. So for the generation of these young men and women, and Amichai is not the youngest. Born in 24, he is 24 by the War of Independence, but not very old either. So when he presents to us one of his really earlier and sort of, if you want to draw an Amichai picture, that would be one of my first lines, God has pity, Elohim Erachem, we normally call it that. Amichai rarely, if ever, named his poems, so we call them by the first line, as you often would do with poems that have no names. Again, let me go quickly through the Hebrew so that just you hear the sound and then we'll come to the translation. This is an official translation, unlike the one I had to do before, and this is by Hannah Bloch from Berkeley. Elohim merachem al yaldei hagan, pachot mize al yaldei bet hasefer, ve'al hagdolim lo yerachem od. Yashirem levadam, ve'lifamim yitzterchu lizchol el arba b'chol aloet kedei lagia, ve'em shotetei dam el tachanat ha'isuf. I could spend the whole session on this stanza, but I will not. God has pity on kindergarten children. He pities school children less, but adults he pities not at all. So if you think back about your readings, whatever they were, and you think back about reading poetry, The whole world is a stage when, in short words, Shakespeare will describe to us the evolvement of human life. Or a big novel about coming of age and understanding who you are, like a Dostoevsky or what have you. Or Miller. This is Amichai's equivalence. In three lines, coming of age in Israel. And from his perspective, early perspective, immediately after the War of Independence, you will want to know the date, right? So you do know. Coming of age in Israel is falling out of God's rachamim. I don't know that the word pity is enough here. The rachamim carries much more meaning than that. Okay? The chesed, the rachamim, etc. So in his experience, when I was a child, kindergarten, safe back in Germany, in our community, our shul, our family, everybody, I felt his rachamim. Going to school already, much less. But when I grew up, or when we grow up in this country, because it's a general statement, there is no I in the poem, just a presenter who stands from the side and describes the process. No pity at all, no rachamim at all. How does he know it? What is that experience that tells the young Amichai coming of age in Israel that God does not pity the big ones? Listen to the language. Look at the Hebrew, those of you who can, for the word gdolim. It's not an adult word. When you want to talk about adults in an adult language, I don't mean porn, I just mean grown up, okay? You would say mevugarim. Who or in what type of Hebrew would you say gdolim when you mean mevugarim? Children's talk, okay? So Amichai is recapturing here an innocence of childhood. Already a child in this country can see that you have the rachamim of God when you're a child, less so in school. And by the time they grow up, I can see the gdolim over there. He has no pity over them. The whole first stanza is from a child perspective. I looked from that perspective at what was happening to the big ones, gdolim, and they had none of the pity of God. How does he know it? I know. He abandons them. Yashirem levadam. It's interesting because normally you would have one word in Hebrew and three or four in English to capture the same meaning. And here it works the other way around. Abandons, one word in English, while the Hebrew carries two, yashirem. They will be left alone. Yashirem levadam. And sometimes they have to crawl on all fours in the scorching sand to reach the dressing station, streaming with blood. If I didn't know when this was written, this stanza will tell me. Because in wars of today, not that we do not have wounded, but when we do, we have the field hospital and the paramedic and the state-of-the-art equipment that our military have and the helicopter that will land immediately and pull them out and take them to the best hospital in the country. Not so in 48. And it's only in the war of 48 that the whole IDF ethic of not abandoning wounded people in the field starts developing after what had happened. I'm opening parentheses. If you know Guri's poem, Hare'ut, the one that we say that Rabin loved to sing so much, about the friendship of the fighting corpses during the War of Independence, it was created after wounded people were abandoned in the field in Metsudat Yesha up north and were tortured. And it's as of that moment that in our collective Israeli psyche, there is that basic ethics of not abandoning. And Amichai, at this point, is not blaming his chevre for having abandoned him, because the ethics does not exist yet as early as that. It's God's abandonment that he feels there. If you are wounded in battle for your country, and there is nobody to carry you to the dressing station. Look at the term dressing station, not field hospital like today. Then you know that God has no pity over you. Wasn't it enough to have fought? Wasn't it enough to have been wounded? I now have to, on four, all fours, on the scorching sand. So if I ask you, where did Amichai fight, you will know immediately. Because poems are so clear to decipher in Israel. Amichai was fighting in the south. Okay? Because if he had fought for Yerushalayim, there will be no scorching sand. And there was no battle in Tel Aviv. Okay? Okay. So we reach sort of almost the middle of the poem, and now we have a classical Amichai. After having so what? Challenged, expressed anger, depression, abandonment. You think the man is now going to, you know, close the door on God, close the door on the divine. You weren't there for me when I needed you. Thank you very much. Shalom. No. You have a classical Amichai switch that starts with, ulai, maybe, you know, על האוהבים באמת ייתן רחמים ויחוס ויצל. Look at the word ויצל, which is a verb out of the noun צל, will shade, will protect with shade, okay? But perhaps he will have pity on those who love truly and take care of them. ייתן רחמים, will take care and shade them. Like a tree over the sleeper on the public bench. So what is a chance for you to maybe feel again your connectedness to God in this country? What needs to happen? You need to be in love. Amichai is ready to accept that if and when his heart will open to love, maybe that opening will allow back the voice of God, the presence of Hashem, the recognition. And how will you know that God is with you again? Where is God in this country? God is in the shade, Batuach. And trust me, today, today, if you went out on the street and you had to wait for a car or taxi or whatever to pick you up, your first thing will be to look, where's the next shade? And it's with the shade that we know Yesh Elohim. It's such an Israeli expression, you know, wow, Yesh, here is God, there is shade. By the way, the only place outside of Israel when I taught this and they totally got it was in Phoenix, Arizona. Okay, so I so love this image. You will so see it in other earlier Israeli poetry of the Chalutzim, how the lack of shade makes them miserable, because all these people come from Europe, from Russia, from forested countries. They miss the shade like you guys miss the bagels and the lox. You know, shade is home. Shade is comfort. And it's so lacking in this country. Okay. Another perhaps. Perhaps even we will spend on them our last pennies of kindness inherited from mother, so that their own happiness will protect us now and on other days. Once you have allowed love and Hashem, there are other options. Actually, the whole realization of the pity of God, where did I get it? Like, let's be fair. I got it from mom. I got it from home. Where did I start feeling pity and kindness and rachamim and goodness? I wasn't in direct connection with Hashem every day of my life, but there was Mom there. And I'm still holding some of those pennies of kindness that she used to distribute. So maybe we will be generous enough and spend on those who are truly in love some of those pennies, because that comes from our past. And so their happiness will be here for us in the future and will protect us now. Uvayamim ha'achirim. There's a whole Amichai anthology of poems called Achshav Uvayamim ha'achirim. Now and in those other days to come. So here's a poem to you that I read totally different from Ze'ev, although you may read it as a similar challenge of incorporating that which you were brought up with, Ze'ev exactly like Amichai, into the everyday discourse, as if saying, note the totally lack of, let me send you to shul, let me send you to study a page of Gemara, you should later fill in every, no, none of that. But an opening of the everyday Israeli life for us to realize that in customs and behaviors from home, in the presence of shade, in true love, you can find connectedness. You do not need to feel abandoned, even if you have a problem. No, I want to make sure that he's okay. Take a minute. Okay. Beseder. Shh. Beseder. Yeah, I can see. I can see that I call Beseder. It's hard today. Ken, ken, mevi'im lo maim. Mevi'im lo maim. Hakol beseder. Comments, questions? Anybody? Okay, Elohim Rachem, Yehuda Amichai, and we turn the page to a much tougher Amichai. The Kikayon, of course. It's so clear to you. Yeah, the presence of a tree, the presence of shade in the Middle East, whether it's here or in far distant cities, it's still the presence of the divine. In this part of the world, yesh Elohim when there is shade. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yes, please. Could you speak up, please? Hang on. It's part of our lore of the War of Independence, the so many armies, that us being outnumbered, etc., which is not exactly true, but we shall not go there right now, okay? It wasn't such a great miracle. We could stand our own, and not all of it was victorious. But never mind, we are not going into 48 history now. We are into the lore of that miraculous war of us being attacked by so many different armies and still standing on our own. But it's not in the poem. And you will find, and in the next poem you will see it even stronger, that the experience that you, reading about it, hearing lectures about it, is one thing. And the experience of the individual soldier from within is a totally different one. And he doesn't see the seven armies. He sees his particular misery when being wounded, having lost faith and refound it maybe on a bench in Tel Aviv in a park on Yerushalayim afterwards when he fell in love. And the whole context of the war, it's just coming to us because of the dressing station. This is our only hint that it's 48. And the whole context is in our mind as we have been studying about it, but not necessarily in the Amichai experience. Okay. Please turn the pages again to a poem, El Mele Rachamim. And now we have a difficulty of what is lost in translation. So I need a show of hands. How many people in the room have absolutely no Hebrew at all? That's great. How many people in the room can hear the similarity and the contrast between the following? El Mele, Il Mele. Is there anybody who doesn't get the difference? Okay. El Mele, God full of mercy. El Mele Rachamim. Il Mele, had it not. So Amichai is playing here on the sound, the similarity between the beginning of a very famous ritual text said at the moment of normally memorial ceremonies, burials, yizkors, etc., El Mele Rachamim, God full of mercy, and his ability to speculate over the text, had it not been Il Mele, which already from the beginning brings you into a situation where the ritual classical prayer text is not just that, but it's a Hebrew text that I understand and can have a conversation with, which may take away something of its sanctity, but it will allow me, or it will show or articulate a fluency in the text. I don't just mumble the words as I was taught. I understand them. And therefore, I can get into a discourse with El Mele Rachamim, which is what Amichai is doing. Again, 48 poem. I'll show you how I know. There's a clue in the poem. El Mele Rachamim. Il Mele ha'el Mele Rachamim. Hayu ha'rachamim ba'olam ve'lo rak bo. God full of mercy, and then they have to explain to the English reader the prayer for the dead. If God was not full of mercy, mercy would have been in the world, not just in him. Now, here is mamash a clash between the person who had been taught to say, El Mele Rachamim, Yoshev Amromim, etc., etc., without fully understanding every single word, and an Amichai that understands every single word to say, what do you mean, God full of mercy? I don't need for him to be full of mercy. I need for a little bit of mercy in this world. Why does he need to be so full of it? And the analogy is meant. Why does it mean to be so full of that pity for that mercy and rachamim when we need it so much in this world? So here is a totally different way of understanding classical Jewish text. You pull it out of the ritual context and you put it in the realm of having an Ivrit Meduberet conversation. Remember when you took those courses of conversational Hebrew? And Amichai is pulling the El Mele Rachamim out of the context of ritual and puts it within conversational Hebrew and is having a conversation. And it's an angry conversation. I don't get it anymore. Don't just recite this prayer to me. What do you mean that he is full of mercy? Had he not been so full of mercy, they may have been a little bit left in the world for me. I who plucked flowers in the hills and looked down into all the valleys, I who brought corpses down from the hills can tell you that the world is empty of mercy. What is the telling line that places this poem in time? What is the line that puts a date on this, in which this poem should have been written before? Yeah. Pardon? One before that. Aye, you made Aliyah too late. You are not allowed to pluck flowers in this country. But you were in the 40s and the early 50s. This is a dating line. This is part of Israeli culture. By the way, one of the very, very few successful campaigns in this country. We didn't have too many about, you know, the cigarette succeeded because that was heavy fines and the not plucking flowers. So let me tell you a little bit about my childhood. You know how old I am. I told you that. So you know that I was a child in the early 50s. We lived in a suburb of Haifa. This is very clean language. It's actually an abandoned Arab village near Haifa where we lived. It took me many, many years to understand that much later. There was nothing much to do, and for sure not on Shabbat if you didn't go to synagogue, and we didn't. But the one big thing to do, excuse me, I know it's one of Lametet Melechot, but I wasn't raised like that. We went out to the hills of the Carmel to pick flowers. This is what you did on Shabbat if you weren't in synagogue. You went out there. Our families could not afford to buy flowers. We didn't have gardens with flowers. We had Amidar Shikunim. And there were the cyclamens and the red ones, how do you call them? Anemones, the kalaniyot, and the narkisim, and all those. And they were wild, and you could pick them, and you had flowers for the whole week at home. And we didn't, but other kids would sell them on the road for people who would drive by, who had cars, bichlal, but anyway. So as soon as Amichai says, I hope had plucked flowers, he is tagging himself generation-wise. I know he belonged to a generation in which this was part of the stuff you have done. Go out in nature and bring flowers home. Okay? But the image of picking flowers is now taken over to picking and carrying another type of flowers that are dead. And look down into all the valleys. I, who brought corpses down from the hills, can tell you the world is empty of mercy. I was raised in Israel, in which you went out into nature to pick flowers. I matured in an Israel when you went out to fight on the hills, and then you had to carry your bodies back. War of Independence. I, who was king of salt. Now, this is a tricky one in the translation because the Hebrew has melach ve-melech. Melech is king, and we use the expression melach ha-aretz, the salt of the earth, like I was really one of those people who belonged, who stood without a decision at my window, who counted the steps of angels, whose heart lifted waves of anguish in the horrible contest. Enigmatic, but we can peel off a few. So first of all, this sense of standing on the seashore. Israel is a narrow country. The seashore is sort of the limit. I went to the end of the land, if you wish to use the David Grossman much later expression. From the hills of Yerushalayim or of the Negev, I also stood at the seashore. I know this country. Stood without a decision at my window, classical Amichai image. Amichai uses a lot this imagery of being inside and outside, standing within a room, looking outside. Me'arba'a nashim b'cheder tamid echad omed el yad chalon. Out of four people in the room, always there is one standing by the window. And therefore, I have the ability to be inside and outside. Maybe look at the world from your perspective, the outside perspective, but at the same time to be inside. I who counted the steps of angels, reminiscing of childhood, of stories, lullabies about going to sleep, maybe, counting the steps of angels. Who knows what reminiscing is here? Whose heart lifted waves of anguish, like his arms lifted the bodies of his friends in the horrible contests, wars, trials, challenges of this country. I who use only a small part of the words in the dictionary. You think I'm a poet? You think I know it all? I have all the words. Let me tell you, nothing. I'm barely scratching. I who must decipher riddles, I do not want to decipher. We need to make meaning. We need to understand what is happening. And it's so hard. Know that if not for the God full of mercy, there would be mercy in the world, not just in him. It's probably a tough time in Amichai's life when he feels that there is a tension between the world, probably of his childhood and growing up, of ritual and unchallenged text, or challenge within the classical okay way of challenging text, and moving out and looking from the outside, looking out of the window, going out into the field, into the hills, encountering the practicalities of Eretz Yisrael, not just Eretz Yisrael of the Gemara and the book and the mitzvot, the practicalities of carrying the bodies of your brothers, which result in a sense of anger at the ritual text. The key is there. Why does he need to have all the pity? I need some of it here. As if challenging the presence of the divine in his everyday life. Any more on that one? Now I really have a dilemma, because I want to go beyond the Amichai, and we have 15 minutes, so let me see which one I will do. Okay. La 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 la. Let's keep the Amichai. No, we'll do the short one, because that one I love so much that I cannot skip. Solitary prayer. It's such a short one and so concise, and lets us see the insights of the Amichai's struggle with faith through the images of two Abbas, Avinu Shebashamayim and his physical biological father. Listen to the Hebrew, just the first line. It's so wonderful. Gam letfilat yachid tzarich shnayim. Like, duh, of course. So why do we call it filat yachid? The solitary prayer also needs two. Like, you cannot have a solitary prayer. You're praying to somebody. Gam letfilat. And again, this is this classical thing of taking a ritual expression, tfilat yachid, and saying, I understand Hebrew. Makala. Ah, toda rabba. My email said 3:45. They say 4 o'clock. Are you okay? Beseder. Let's go. A solitary prayer also needs two. Always one who moves and the other who doesn't move. That one is God. Oy, we still have some of that anger. Tamid echad shemitnoea, and you can see Amichai's memories probably from early childhood of his father back in Shul, of the Chevrei in the Beit HaMidrash in their community, and who knows where, the moving ones, the prayer was your body, your whole body. So there is always one that moves, and there is one that doesn't, and that one is God. The unshakable, the unmovable, and if I want to go, the possible, Amichai challenges the inflexible. Okay, the rigid one. But when my father prayed, he stood in his place, upright and unmoving. He forced God to move like a reed and pray to my father. Interesting. Was his father like that all the time? Had something changed in his father's relationship to God? Was there a moment, possibly post-Holocaust, the immediate family was saved, but everybody who stayed back in Germany wasn't? And Amichai had sensed a change in his father. Because how would he know about the person who always moves? He had seen it. And then at a certain point, he starts looking at his father, and his father doesn't move. And since in Amichai's understanding, the relationship of prayer is that somebody needs to be moving, something needs to shake to move, and only one is allowed to stay upright. If Dad had adopted the position of the rigid one, then God will have to become flexible. Then God will have to be like a reed. Is it still angry? Is it a new discovery? Is there a new relationship with God that Amichai is discovering much later poem, much, much later than the ones we have read before? In the next few minutes, yes, please. I'm going to say something which is not Amichai, it's me. And one has to be very careful in bringing one's own understandings into the reading of poems. And then, on the other hand, what else are we doing when we are reading poems but bringing our own experiences into the reading of the poem? I was born much later than Amichai. I was born in 46. But I was raised by Holocaust survivors. One generation back, I come from an observant, what probably today they would call modern Orthodox. My mom would never use that expression. She would say, you mean Jewish, right? Okay. And my mom had an issue with God after the Holocaust. Now we had all Shabbat services and candle lighting and fasting on Yom Kippur and getting crazy before Seder on Pesach and whatever. But I know that prayer was an issue. Prayer was an issue for many years. Like, what's the sense? He didn't listen when I prayed so hard back there. And we did everything we were supposed to do. And then I know of a phase in my mother's life in which she came about and sort of was able to pray again. And that came with the first grandchild. As if, okay, you took away so much, but you let me become a Safta, fine. another victory over Hitler. Every single grandchild and great-grandchild, of course. Of course, that was the language. This too is a victory over Hitler, of course. You understand that language. This is how I was raised. So I may be reading some of my own into this. I may be reading some of a whole generation, because between Amichai and me, there are actually two generations of children of not really survivors, but people who have lost so much, because in Amichai's case, he's not a child of a survivor. But he comes from a family that was almost totally destroyed back there. So maybe he could have seen something of that in his father's behavior after the war. I do not know. But this suggests a change from the classical relationship, the one who doesn't move is God, and then in my father's new relationship with God, the one I'm describing to you, I know that something had happened. And Dad couldn't move, and since you always need somebody who will move in a prayer, because even a solitary prayer needs two, then maybe. That's my reading. Any more on that? Okay, I need to take you, we will skip the Kosman one for a minute, the Admiel Kosman, and if there is time, we'll come back to it, because I need to give you a taste from a totally, totally different type of discourse or dialogue or conversation with God, with Hashem, in contemporary Israeli literature, that is not as easily connected to classical texts. And it's the prayer-like poetry that is composed in this country. All the way, the one we are going to read here is, I think, from the 50s, and another one is from the 70s. I remember when it was first published, and so on. I was already a reader of poetry at the time, the Ariana Haran one. So I want to give you a little bit of background and to hopefully have you accept that the creation of prayer-like poetry, piyut-like writing, is a growing tradition in our people. And like many of our prayers, they do not come straightly from Torah. Some of them are much later, Middle Ages and more. And therefore, why not accept modern Israeli literature as expressing the need to pray when I cannot connect to the Siddur as it had been put in my hands or had not been put in my hands at all? So Leah Goldberg, not a very traditional background, growing up between Königsberg in Germany and very upper middle class, a family in Russia after the revolution, not a solid Jewish background there. Much more universal literature, Russian, French, Italian influences that you will see in her writing. And then in an amazing book that when I'm a very young adult would be a classical gift to a young woman, Mukdam u'Mu'akhar by Leah Goldberg, you will find this poem. Now, oddly enough, since I travel the Jewish world and oftentimes am invited into Reform congregations, the Reform Siddur now includes these verses. And so in Siddur, you never quote the writer, the poet of the text. So Reform congregants throughout the Jewish world who find this poem in their Sidurim, you mean, but that's the Lamdeini. Like they would say that's the Aleinu or something, you know? For them, it's like a classical ritual text. What am I talking to them about Leah Goldberg? But it is Leah Goldberg, trust me, okay? Way before it went into the Sidurim. So, yes, please. Mukdam u'Mu'akhar, early and late, no English translation. These are homemade translations. Very little of Leah Goldberg had been translated into English, very little. You'll find some on the internet. So here, it's a great one for me because it expresses this need to pray after probably having lived a prayerless life. So there comes a moment in your life, you have been raised in a very rational type of family. What do you mean all that voodoo kind of thing? That's nothing, that's the superstition. And yet you reach a point and you say, no, I need to pray. And the Siddur is not my book. I'll create my prayer. But actually, she's not creating a prayer. She's expressing the need to be taught how to pray. That which did not exist in her childhood, that which did not Lamdeni, how to pray, you would say to your mom, to your dad, or you don't even need to say, they will teach you. But she was raised without it. And therefore she needs at an older age, turn to whatever, the Almighty, and ask to be taught to express a prayer. Let's listen to the Hebrew. It's so beautiful. למדני אלוהי ברך והתפלל על סוד עלי כמל על נוגה פרי בשל על החירות הזאת לראות לחוש לנשום לדעת ליחל ולהיכשל למד את שפתותיי ברכה ושיר הלל בהתחדש יומך עם בוקר ועם ליל לבל יהיה יומי היום כתמול שלשום לבל יהיה יומי עלי הרגל. Teach me, O Lord, to bless and to pray, ברך והתפלל. For the secret of a withered leaf, the glow of ripe fruit. For this freedom to see, to sense, to breathe, to know, to hope, to fail. Teach my lips to bless and praise, each new day, morning and evening, lest today will like yesterday and the day before, lest my day be ordinary. Yeah, lest my day, leval yehe yomi elai hergel. Is it kol kach? I know so much is lost in translation in this poem. I know the rhythm of the Hebrew is unbelievable here. Yes, ma'am. I said, yes, there is 2 years ago a book. Yeah. Okay, Toda Rabba, thank you. I didn't realize that. Toda Rabba, thank you. Let's go to another one. Still, yes, please. You could be my son. My son sees Hasidish in everything. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. But of course, the connection to God is there from the beginning. Because. I'd like to build on that. Because oftentimes people who do not have the hergel of prayer, because many of you guys here have the hergel of prayer, and the custom, the everyday behavior, and she comes from a hergel-less kind of world, and she is even concerned about the kind of prayer that she will be taught, that she needs to pray in a way that will not make her day hergel. That will be a meaningful connection. But also, I read in the first line, the Lamdeni, Elohai Barech V'itpalel. In Hebrew, oftentimes, when you respectfully speak of your parents, you use the term Avi Mori or Imi Morati. By that, you mean they taught me. And they didn't, in her case. Nachon meod. Okay. Let's turn the page to Ariana Haran to Bakasha, request. Now, that's a fun one, and you need to know Ariana Haran, because for sure you will, if you'll find one poem by Ariana Haran somewhere translated on the internet, I'll be surprised and grateful if you did. Ariana Haran was raised in a Shomer Tzair kibbutz. Not much chance to have a lot of prayer in her life. Then the woman goes ahead and falls in love with one of the first conservative rabbis in this country, Harav Avidora Kohen. You know, like God creates all sorts of shiduchim. It happens, malasot. I think he is the first one who had an Erev Shabbat program on Israeli TV back there in the day when we had TV like 3 times a week or something, and we had an hour and a half Erev Shabbat. And then Avidora Kohen would go and speak a little bit about the Parsha or whatever. So many non-observant Israelis, that would be one of their earliest encounters with a conversational Yahadut, okay? The stuff that you can talk about in a regular language that I understand. Not scary, but Knesset language, okay? Now, Ariana Haran, I did not know about her as a poet. I came across her writing through a weird book. I'm actually a foodie. Many people know that about me, so I'm telling you again. And so I always look for interesting cookbooks. And before internet days and stuff, you really had to look for books. And at the time, I can calculate very easily, Uri, my oldest, was born in 70, and Tali, my youngest and second, and these are the two kids I have, in 71. So they go into the military in 88 and 89. And when you have kids in the military, you have to send pekalach, right? With stuff. And so, didn't you know that? That's part of parenting in Israel. So she wrote a book of recipes of cakes that you could bake and send to the army, and they will not spoil within 3 or 4 days. And they did not need to be, you cannot find the book anymore. Okay, I have the recipes though. Okay, so I really love that book. And I started inquiring who this woman was, and it was written with a beautiful sense of humor, and also talking to kibbutznikim, so take the product in from here and from there, you know, very kibbutz language, and so on. And then I discovered that she was a poet as well, and I was wondering, and she ran a kosher traditional home with her husband, who was the rav of the first conservative keila in Rehovot, where a friend of mine is a rabbi today, and whatever. And then I came across this bakasha, again, homemade translation. When I say homemade translation, in most cases, I mean Shulamit Berman, who from Efrat, who used to work with me at the Jewish Agency and made it possible for me to teach many of these poems who did not have kosher, like famous translators. Okay, so this woman entering this world of ritual and whatever, probably loving her husband dearly, but finding it hard to figure out her way in the Siddur and Machzor, and yet connecting, understanding the need. And I can just visualize, this is me, not Ariana Haran. It says, you know, there are so many beautiful prayers, and there is stuff that I need and is not in the book, so I'm going to write it. Bakasha, like Sifrei Bakashot, you know? Okay. Hayetov elenu veten lenu harbe zman. Isn't that a woman's poem? Be good to us and give us a great deal of time. Time to see each person separately. And perhaps even to love them. Time to look at the ceiling and wonder what the angels think about. Time for beautiful things that are worth living for. Time for a lot of foolishness, from which wisdom will come. Time to gaze into eyes and learn their color by heart. A lot of time to think of all these things together. Just completing a missing niche in the book of prayers. Yeah, we need blessing for this, that, and the other, but you know what? I need time, leisure time, relaxed time. Not rushing between baking for the military and being the Rebbetzin and all that. Just time for myself. Last but not least, we have to finish with Kobi. I said, isn't this a woman poem? Isn't this a woman's poem? Kobi Oz, originally from Sderot. Yeah, everybody knows Sderot for Qassam missiles and such. But Sderot is the heart and the birthplace of a lot of Israel's rock music. Sderot is the heart and the birthplace of a lot of Israel's modern Mizrahi music. An amazing number of now contemporary young writers have been born and raised in Sderot, most of whom have moved to Tel Aviv by now. But anyway, a couple of years ago, Kobi Oz... Now again, look at the Oz. It's in Ivrit. It's in with Aleph, not with an Ayin. So he's not pretending to be like Amos Oz. If you read him only in English, you wouldn't know that. But this is really a phase in your life, being born to an Algerian family, North African. Then you don't want to have the very Algerian name that everybody will recognize, Ozeri. So you will become Oz for short. That's already half a step towards Tel Aviv, right? And then, at a certain point, you grow up, and Kobi Oz's grandfather was a paitan, a North African paitan. And when Kobi had his bar mitzvah, his grandfather sang some piyutim at the bar mitzvah, and he sang along with him. And then at a much later phase in life, I'm going to say about 10 years ago, he takes that video clip from the bar mitzvah and he is having a musical dialogue with his long dead grandfather, where he adds a modern Israeli piyut to his classical North African grandfather's one. So Abba, Hoy Av, Rachaman, he starts like this, and then he will move into the very contemporary language. Be my true soulmate. Pad my heart with faith. Let me fear your name. That's Saba. That's the song of Saba the Peitan, to which he will now respond, the Kobi Oz from Sderot / Tel Aviv. I didn't get myself a rabbi, and my laws are improvisations. When I'm distressed, I take a pill. I'm so advanced that I come from apes, and all my shortcomings are my parents' faults. Here is no true furrow, just a multi-lane highway leading to the general shopping mall. If a miracle happens, it's vague and certainly not caused by me. Father or merciful father, again, the Saba is bringing in the incantation of the classical. Thus I have prayed in a minyan of Jews, next to me a Haredi trembling with fear. For the sake of God, he is a systematic robot, drenched in sweat, blessed with children, next to us a national religious who worships earth, wallowing in the past, glorifying victories to come. And we all live on his sword, an immigrant, a shamash with a hump, a reform with a new dress or gender, a conservative and his young one, a bar mitzvah boy. Sweet, les kazar kuzari. They are free, whispering from behind, scarves, wigs, and hairstyle. Behind the screen, mechitza, pargod. High in the is a female voice. Yes, those not counted. Rabban Yochanan Bezakai from Evab weeps from sorrow or joy. A raindrop of a tear he whipped away, and I sighed. We are all your students, great hammer, Patisha Gadol. Candle of Israel, right pillar, bless all your children of all the shades, religious as well as secular. Toda rabba, tzom kal, unechama.